Yeah, I guess we can thank you guys for that. I mean, y'all kind of wrote us off, in a sort of way, so appreciate that.
Alabama now faces Indiana in the Rose Bowl on January 1st. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
And I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Oh, those dulcet tones means it's time once again here on this rather brisk morning on the Augustana College campus. But friends, you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Gary Stoppelman from the Dubuque Museum of Art. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio as it's meant to be brewed on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Well, Gary, I first and foremost want to thank you for making that US 61 commute. I think you grow up in this part of the country, and at least in the Quad Cities or Dubuque, and you're going to get familiar with that road over time.
Oh, yeah. It's my entree to Iowa came right through here, and I remember stopping at the Figge for the first time and meeting with my colleague then, the then director, and coming to understand I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a great legacy of art here, and I can't wait to dive into that. But how were the roads?
It's a beautiful morning.
It is. It's going to be nice. I think you got rid of all the stuff.
A couple weeks ago,
yeah.
And we're going to be 60 by Christmas.
And you make it through the big S-curve at the Makoka to Midway.
The only dangerous moment was just down the road here.
Yeah?
That little curve to come up the hill to get to here. That was a little dicey.
Well, that's the thing about living in river towns, right? We've always got hills.
Yeah.
And if you live there long enough, you learn which ones, and it's been cleared here since day one. Rock Island really does a good job on snow removal, but you learn which streets you can trust in a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And which ones are a little more tetchy.
Actually, so. It's part of why I've felt at home is I grew up in New England.
All right.
So instantly upon coming to the River Valley, I grew up outside of Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay, and whereabouts? So
it's a town called Manchester, Connecticut, just east of Hartford, between Hartford and the University of Connecticut.
In Storrs. Yeah, yeah.
And so being after a number of years in the Midwest, being in this river valley, all of a sudden it was like, oh, this feels familiar.
Wow. Well, I wanted to find out. I'm a nosy guy. I got to warn you, Gary. And I wanted to learn more about where you grew up. The reason I know Storrs is that, speaking of art, Augustana received a very generous donation of modern Swedish art from the 1880s to the 1980s from a couple, Sam and Ann Charters. Now, Ann was on the English faculty at Connecticut, and they were married and were kind of rebellious, if you will. And in the 70s, Sam, as an act of protest, became a Swedish citizen shortly after the bombings in Cambodia. And so she maintained dual citizenship with her job, of course, at Storrs. And I had a delightful opportunity to come visit her. But it all started with this remarkable art collection and some stuff that is, I think it's high time we do another show of it here. We've had it now for, I got to think here, about 10, 12 years. And we've had it on exhibit a couple of times, different bits. And then we've sent it out on trips. But it gave me a slight appreciation of Storrs and that part of Connecticut, which is just beautiful.
Yeah.
Rolling hills, the roads go winding through. I ate at some inn that had been there since the 1700s or something like that. Great stuff. And that's where you were a kid.
Yeah. And, of course, one of the great things is that at the university, with their agricultural history, they have a great dairy, so you can have some very good ice cream.
That's right. I did have that. So Sam's interest, he was an ethnomusicologist. Mm-hmm. And before he emigrated, he spent a lot of time recording folk blues musicians in the Deep South and created this collection that the university holds as well. But it's I think it's been shared with the Smithsonian. And he made these incredible recordings of like first-gen artists of the recorded age, right? So fascinating all the way around. And New England is very much on my mind right now because through a weird set of circumstances, I find myself rereading John Irving's The Cider House Rules.
Oh, wow.
Which is, of course, down east in Maine, right? Yeah. And so quite a ways away. But I'm just picturing those landscapes and the smell, the faint smell of the salt air and all that kind of stuff. So how? What then prompted you to head out of that idyllic setting?
So I grew up outside of Hartford, Connecticut. At the time that I was growing up, Connecticut was dealing with some really interesting segregation issues.
Yeah.
The town I grew up in at the time was about 90%, where I was going to school, was about 90% white. And so I had the opportunity on a voluntary desegregation program to go to a magnet school in Hartford, Connecticut, a magnet school for the arts. And that is where I found my tribe. And the rest is history from there. I went to New York and was there for about 20 years. Met and married a good Midwesterner. And that's what brought us to the Midwest. And
we have a way of doing that. You know, we lure you in.
I've been here ever since. So we spent about 20 years in New York. And we left for Chicago in 2008. I went to Chicago.
Yeah.
We were in Chicago, Indianapolis, and now Dubuque.
Wow, that's quite a tour.
Yeah.
So you talked about getting this interest in the arts in high school, which is fantastic. Were there particular genres of art that were more attractive to you, or were you in this
realm? So now we're getting into where some of this is where I warned you I'm going to ask you questions too, you know, because I was actually a theater geek.
Me too.
So I grew up, that was my entree into the world of the arts.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought I was going to be an actor. And I went to New York and I went to NYU and I studied theater and I had this deep immersion in that world and came out very quickly, learned that I didn't want to be a performer, but that I loved the arts and I wanted more people to have the experience that I had, where they learned that their voice could be honored and could be welcomed, and I wanted more people to get involved. And that's the trajectory ever since. Although I started and stayed in theater. I went to work for New York Theater Workshop, which was actually run at the time by their artistic director, was actually from the same hometown. And I happened to be there at the moment that a little Broadway show called Rent was being incubated out of there.
Oh my.
And it was an amazing time to be 20-something in that theater. From there, I went to a slightly bigger theater. From there, it was through a theater connection that I ended up at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And I had no idea. I didn't know anything about museums. And I've been doing museum work now for 25 years.
My goodness. I love stories like that, where you're not exactly sure where you're heading, but there's this flow.
Yeah.
That kind of continues, like a river.
Like a river. Right?
It just keeps pushing you along, whether it's the Hudson or the Mississippi, it doesn't
matter.
Or the Connecticut, exactly. That's fascinating. So you talked about some gigs then in the Midwest, including Chicago.
Correct.
Tell us about this sojourn. I'm finding it fascinating.
So I ended up being the new expansion guy. So the project at MoMA was that we were moving from Midtown Manhattan, Fifth Avenue Manhattan, to Long Island City, Queens, to a swing line staple factory in Long Island City, Queens, which was completely industrial at the time.
Yeah.
For 2.5 years while the new museum was being built. And that was an amazing project that happened to coincide with 9/11, and we can go down that rabbit hole.
Sure, sure.
From there, I went to the Met and worked on the opening of the Greek and Roman galleries at the Met. And from there, I went to the Art Institute when they built the modern wing. So I came a year ahead of the opening. and stayed for another almost 10 years, I think, and then went to Indianapolis after we sort of stabilized things post 08 and post recession. Worked on a different transformational project, and now here I am in Dubuque.
Gary, would you mind if I asked about your 9/11 experience, where you were?
Sure. Well, where we were particularly, it was primary day. So my wife and I had just voted. So we were on the same train, and she's an attorney. She worked right above Grand Central. And so I was sitting in a train that was just sitting under Grand Central. And she went up and heard the cops talking and came down and got me. And she went to her office, and I went right into an Irish bar above, right next to Grand Central. At the time, we just thought it was like a Cessna, you know, some idiot accidentally flown into the, right? And we had no idea. And that was about the time that the second plane hit. We ended up, I went to the office. Of course, we closed, but we had, because we had a big theater, we were able to gather, and my wife came up and joined us. And I think we watched the news in the theater at the museum. Before everyone from Manhattan walked home. We lived in Brooklyn at the time. It was, you know, I look back on that now, and I remember a few days later when the museum reopened and reopened for free, it really, it was one of those moments where you understand the power of gathering, whether it's in a theater or whether it's in a museum.
Yeah.
And what art experiences can do to bring us together, create a space of empathy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always find it fascinating. My own example is, to borrow from Twain, a lightning bug compared to your lightning. I'll never forget, I was driving my daughter to elementary school, and I always listen to WVIK, and there's Carl Castle. If you remember Carl Castle, the great newscaster who never flubbed anything, and he flubbed because somebody must have handed this to him. And my surmise is his mind was like all of the ours and yours. Yeah. Well, some Cessna, some idiot, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I can't imagine listening to Carl Castle flub.
And he made a little flub. And I thought, wow, that's weird. And then I dropped my daughter off. And by the time I head into the office, things are coming clearer in here in the Central Time Zone that this was terribly bad. And then, like you, office mates and I gathered around the one TV in the office. I mean, nowadays we'd all be around our phones and separated, but we hung together and watched that. And it happened that it was a terrible but and yet cathartic moment. So thank you for sharing your story about that. Now you say we get you to the Art Institute, our home team, among others, right? That came to mind just because have you ever heard of the game Masterpiece?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so I was gushing about this. We played that when we were kids.
Yeah, of course.
And our college library has a collection of games. And I was like, holy cow, I couldn't find it in my ma's house when we were shutting things down. So it was gone. There it was. So I played it with my now 26-year-old son and a couple of granddaughters. And it was my son who was the first one to notice all of those paintings were from the Art Institute.
That's correct.
I had no idea. I thought they were, and what a testament to the great collection that the Art Institute has and the phenomenal wealth that Chicago has had.
It's really amazing.
So what all did you do at the Art Institute?
So I helped them open the Modern Wing.
Yeah, you said you mentioned that.
And so, I was the director of marketing there from, gosh, let's see, I think 08 to, I think that too was, you know, we sold, I remember, talk about sort of lightning moments. I wish I knew what I was doing, but when it came to real estate, we happened to sell our apartment in New York the day that Lehman crashed.
Holy moly.
And by the skin of our teeth. So yeah, I was there post recession and through the tumult of 08 and we opened the Modern Wing in 09, and I was there through sort of regrowth and stabilization through 15, and then went to take on a different project in Indianapolis.
Yeah, you mentioned Indianapolis too. Tell us about that part of the journey.
So in Indianapolis, I was the deputy director for external affairs for the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And not unlike really most American museums, it was a museum that was trying to figure out if they were going to grow or if they were going to get smaller. And they did not want to get smaller. And the amazing thing about that museum is that, and again, not dissimilar from some of the opportunities in Chicago being on Grant Park, and not dissimilar from the Dubuque Museum of Art being on Washington Park, that property, that museum, sat on 150 acres of gardens and sculpture park. And so it was about helping people find the connections across, to borrow a university term, across curriculum, right? And to come to understand, to see the connections across horticulture and culture and music and other forms, indoors and out. And now we're trying to do the same in Dubuque.
Well, and we are going to get to Iowa's oldest cultural institution here in just a minute. But this is the time every week, Gary, when we step aside for a venerated hero of our community, Dr. Roald Tweet. He gifted us, as part of his legacy, this wonderful collection of stories about our town and up and down the river. So you never know what you're going to hear, but it's time for Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Before I moved to the Mississippi River, I used to worry about God. He never seemed to have much fun. Oh, no question but that he did good work. His zebra had just the right proportion of black and white stripes. His giraffe's neck and back were so angled as to make you want to slide down it like a banister. And his elephant looked exactly the way an animal named elephant should look. But God seemed so straight. Let there be light. And then he says, it is good. Wouldn't you have just sat down and giggled to suddenly see everything lit up like a Christmas tree for the first time? Too much Protestant work ethic is what I thought. That was before I moved to Rock Island and found out about the Mississippi's spoonbill catfish. You only need to see one to know that along about 3:30 on the fifth day of creation, somewhere in between the eagle and the great whale, both exacting work, God took a little dribble of extra clay and made a joke, as boys will do when the study hall teacher relaxes her vigilance for an instant. In fact, he made two of them. One he put in China on one side of the world, and the other in the Mississippi River. Have you ever seen a 7-foot spoonbill catfish? They look like a bloated shark that set out to swallow a canoe paddle and got bored with the job about halfway through. Or perhaps it's a chronic head cold that gives it that nose. Whatever the case, they rarely move from the mud at the bottom of the river. They feed by keeping their mouths open, hoping that food bits will find their way in. They won't take a fisherman's bait. Instead, you have to drag your hook along the muddy bottom, hoping to snag one. Should you do so, you're in for the same thrill as pulling a waterlogged rubber boot to the surface, except that the boot tastes better. The difference between spoonbill steak and spoiled lutefisk is not marked, or so I'm told. All creation fits into some great plan, except for the spoonbill catfish. Yet I'm glad it's there in the river. Knowing God can take a joke ought to make us all rest a little easier.
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
Yeah, that little homage to a spoonbill, that's one of the strangest things. And my guest, by the way, Gary Stoppelman from the Dubuque Museum of Art. Gary,
speaking of strange things.
No, I'm sorry. I always forget to reintroduce my guest. No, this is delightful, not at all strange. But so I grew up just a few blocks from here and a couple blocks up from the river. And so my buddies and I would spend large chunks of the summer, evading Rock Island Lines trains as they lumbered across, cutting through the parking lot at the International Harvester plant, and then getting down to a little place called Sylvan Island, which offered great fishing. And I'll never forget the first time I saw a spoonbill. I mean, they just looked like I love Tweet's description. He says it looks like a shark started swallowing a canoe paddle and then gave up halfway. It's just they're the most atrocious things. I love them though because they're like pelicans. Because pelicans, there's no reason in all of physics that they should be able to fly, and yet they do. Yeah, and spoonbills, they do their fun thing.
There's also no reason that there should be sharks in the Mississippi, but we'll leave that for now.
There are no sharks in the Mississippi. I'm not worried about that. I remember though, every summer we go up to the northern reaches of Lake Michigan. And when my nieces and nephews, who are all well grown now, when they were little kids, the news of the day was they discovered a shark. and what it was some idiot disposed of like an aquarium shark, just knowing he was going to get all this. And so they were afraid to go jumping into Michigan.
As they should be.
But it was just fine. Okay, so Gary Stoppelman, director of the Dubuque Museum of Art, has already woven a wonderful tale, but now I'm dying to know, how did we get you here along the shores of the mighty Mississippi?
Yeah, it's sort of a crazy, crazy fit. My courtship with the museum lasted, I think, about a week.
Oh.
It was just, hey, this is what we're looking for. What are you looking for? Hey, this is what I'm looking for. That's who we are. That's who I am. Let's do this. And we came to Dubuque, my wife and I. I think my interview was on a Thursday electronically. And then we came that weekend, and I remember we were leaving on Sunday, driving back to Indianapolis, and we looked at each other and we both said, huh, that didn't stink. And they said, well, we'll talk about it tomorrow. And it's been great. I mean, this, what an exciting opportunity to take. I was recruited literally with the words, we want to do something spectacular.
Wow. That is very attractive.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned your spouse has some Midwestern roots.
Yeah,
where is she from?
She's from Northern Indiana.
She grew up
in a different university town. She grew up half an hour south of South Bend.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Well, yeah. And Dubuque is an extremely seductive community. You come rolling in, at least when we drive up here from the Quad Cities.
Yeah, it's so
beautiful.
And
you sort of gently flow down into this
dramatically gently.
Yes, it's a valley. And
it was a theatrical reveal.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Yeah, thank you. And then again, I mean, we then pop across the river on our way up north. But I've had some wonderful experiences there with the Mississippi River Museum.
Yeah.
With the Julianne Dubuque Hotel. Yeah. Is a delight.
Yeah.
And some fun places to just kind of kick back and hang out. But I need to confess to you, Gary, I've never enjoyed the museum. And
well,
that's going to change.
I'm here.
That's why you're here. So you can tell us all about it. Well, and actually, before we go any further, where can we find out about it online?
So you can find all about us at dbqart.org.
Wonderful. dbqart.org. And there are really heady things going on here. So you mentioned they brought you in for spectacular, and you've recently received a spectacular commitment of a financial donation.
Yeah, so it's an amazing, we can go through the whole history because that too flows like a river. You know, it's a 150-year-old organization. For 125 of those years, it's itinerant. Immediately prior to our, what we think of as our historic location, immediately prior, they are literally hanging art in the old county jail. Literally hanging art in the old county jail.
Wow.
And then 26 years ago, a group of far forward-thinking leaders dedicated a former community bank building, beautiful form, to be the first dedicated home for what was then known as the Dubuque Art Association. And by establishing that dedicated home, instantly and dramatically exponential growth for the collection in particular. Mm-hmm. So by the early 2000s, they're already busting at the seams there. And in 2016, another group of foresighted leaders purchased some of the property on that block, knowing that they're going to have to expand. There wasn't a specific vision, just time to control our destiny. And then in 2018, a campaign is kicked off, and it's going to be about a $14 million campaign, sort of a slightly bigger version of who they were at the time. And then in 2020, everything changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
COVID hits, my predecessor leaves, the executive committee of the board organically turns over, racial reckoning changes the context in which we all work.
Right.
And we take a pause, and I'm brought in, and like I said, there wasn't really a, other than the fact that this collection had exploded and now is numbering 2,700 works and there's less than 1% of it is out, there wasn't a real understanding or commitment to the who and the why, or even the where, actually. We had a lot of fun thinking about where we might expand.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, ended up right back where we started. But which was another COVID lesson, but we went from a little $14 million idea to a complete and total transformation, we hope, of Iowa's first art museum.
Wow. Let's talk about that early history. I mean, our communities, Dubuque and the Quad Cities, owed their early existence and wealth to the river.
Yeah.
It happens that the first rail bridge over the river was here, and of course Dubuque was strategically located a long ways to get to the mines of Galena and the whole region, mm-hmm. and then opening up into the great Northwest, the old Northwest. But how did that fuel this cultural life?
I think in so many ways, and in so many ways that are continuing to take us in new directions, and I'll explain what I mean. So, of course, you mentioned mining, but another, which was core to the Western expansion and core to the economic expansion of that area, led in particular during the Civil War. But another important force was millworking.
Mm.
And so, you know, these logs would come down the river, and in Dubuque, they would get turned into beautiful parts of homes and mm-hmm. buildings and we would argue works of art. And that area, the historic millworking district, is where we've temporarily relocated to. And it is a gorgeous, vibrant destination with these 125-year-old buildings that have hosted all kinds of making and creativity and manufacturing and some very important art for over 100 years. And now today are the place that everybody wants to live and have entertainment and go out for a drink or a meal or a museum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love stories of how art moves physically. I mean, when we had those terrible floods in Iowa City,
yeah.
suddenly the Figge here in the Quad Cities got to be the refuge
yeah.
for some amazing works
yeah.
That we got kind of used to having around here, and then they had to go away again.
Yeah, not
right?
too far.
But there is something about where you geographically situate art.
Absolutely.
That's very determinative.
Yeah, and you know, again, we can go back to the role of academics. So an important part of the growth of learning and the growth of art was the women's religious orders in Dubuque. And, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it's my supposition. So Dubuque is a 50,000 person city, and we punch way above our
weight. Oh, yeah.
We've got two museums that are accredited and affiliated with the Smithsonian. We have a symphony. You know, we've got streets alive with murals. We have a number of different schools and programs and incredible local theater program. So I think that there one thing that has been a differentiator for us, I think, is those women religious orders and their influence on the cultural and educational life. But you're absolutely right. The river, too. I mean, the fact that we sit at this intersection of Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa means that when we do what we call our biennial, which pulls from a 250-mile radius, mm-hmm. that extends all the way up to Minnesota and St. Paul and all the way east to Chicago. And so, and now we've been studying, with our current exhibitions, we've been studying some of the indigenous tribes of the mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. I mean, It's really fascinating.
And, of course, Dubuque is the city of five flags, yes. Right? All the different places that have claimed it at one time or another. Also, I mean, the topography is amazing.
Yeah.
I've long loved that. My old man and I used to occasionally trip off to Guttenberg, and then even further up, going further up the valley and seeing all those amazing things, and all that's in striking distance. And the Mines of Spain.
And the Mines of
Spain. Tell our listeners about the Mines of Spain.
The Mines of Spain are probably one of the most beautiful, dramatically beautiful, easily accessible. There's something called the Horseshoe Bluff that... You would think you were in the Alps, except for the fact that it only took you a half an hour to circle this bluff, and it's just so beautiful. All seasons, changing throughout the seasons, and the views over the Mississippi. And like I said, it is both world-class beauty and, you know, like a half an hour walk and an hour from here.
Well, you bring up a good point that I'm just curious about. The this area had some... local artists, locally active, who the landscapes caught their eye. There was a guy named Frank Lundahl in Moline, another Olaf Grafström, and there were even some who weren't Swedish. No, but does the collection include some Dubuque origined artists who were capturing this beauty?
So, I mean, it goes all the way back to the founding of the Art Association.
Ah.
So, the Art Association was really founded to help people get involved, sort of on that same idea of let's learn, let's see if we can learn more about each other and about the role that art and culture plays in our lives. And one of the things that is completely woven into the fabric of this museum, at least since the beginning of the 20th century, is the role of making. Again, and so in its sort of second iteration at the turn of the 20th century, 19th into 20th century, that's when the local leaders really came to understand that if they really wanted to expand the engagement with the arts, that it was going, one of the keys to that was going to be education. And they brought in an artist, educator, scholar from the Art Institute of Chicago, named Adrian Dornbusch. And it was really through that active making, I think, that you could, I would draw a line back to that moment from, if you wanted to explore, why are the arts flourishing to such a degree in Dubuque?
Then along the way, you have these people who garner great wealth from being in these geographic situations, and their generosity is shared with the broader community. Who are some of those heroes for the Museum of Art?
It's an amazing little story. So at this moment that Adrian Dornbusch comes in, the Lull family, L-U-L-L, at that time the Art Association was at the, again, sort of, what is the, where, how do we spread this civic engagement? They were a part of the library, the Carnegie Stout Library. And the Lull family donated money specifically to purchasing art for the community. The works that that family purchased, those funds were used to purchase with the Art Association through the library, are now some of the core strengths of our collection. And they also, again, sort of tie back to this back and forth with Chicago. A young man named Grant Wood had just, in 1931, had just had national recognition when the Art Institute purchased his American Gothic directly out of a show there. And then so the next year, that was 1930, the next year in 1931, his next two paintings were purchased with funds from the Lull Fund.
Okay. All right. Well, and we've got to talk about, of course, Grant Wood, and where you can, I mean, you can see different things of his and his school at different museums around the state of Iowa. What are some of the Wood-related works that you guys have?
I would argue that we have the two most important paintings outside of Chicago.
All right.
Which is, they're, again, painted immediately after American Gothic, and that's Appraisal and Victorian Survival, two works that really speak to us today about the about class, about technology, about a changing American landscape, and We also have, so those are the two most important paintings of his that we have in our collection. And then we also have the complete, all of his lithographs, again, through another local benefactor who's still with us, who I would argue we wouldn't even be an art museum without, and that would be Dr. Randy Langland.
All right. One of my favorites in the Figge is the Stone City.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you get to see some of these other related artists. One of my great art museum adventures was I was at a higher ed conference in San Francisco, and I there was a friend of the college who has a wing at the DeYoung named after her. Mm-hmm. So her assistant got me a pass to go see the DeYoung, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm trekking away from my conference. I know I'm playing a little bit of hooky. I get in there. I'm so excited to see all these wonderful things. And most of the museum was given over to a Grant Wood exhibition.
Yeah, you
and
can't
about half
it.
Of it was from the Figge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. Well, listen, my guest, Gary Stoppelman from the Dubuque Museum of Art, I'm having a ball learning about this incredible treasury that's just upriver from us. But this is the time every week where we step aside for just a moment. And this was a fraught decision, Gary, because this is the last Saturday before Christmas. And so the opportunities are endless. And I decided
you weren't going to make me Carol.
No. We're good. There is no. Don't worry. I listen to other people's music at this time. The problem, though, or the challenge or opportunity was, I tend to be a bit of a classicist. I mean, I could go with Linus and Lucy every day, all day, but then I was challenged to think of something a little bit newer. And so this is a work that's only a couple of years old, but it's become a favorite for Mrs. Swanson and myself. This is Jimmy Fallon and Meghan Trainor with a relatively new Christmas carol that's called Wrap Me Up.
It's Christmas time, my dear. And we said no gifts this year. I got one question, if you'd let me. What did you get me? Is it a tie? An ugly sweater? Matching pajamas? So something better? Is it bougie like Gucci? Man, I thought I had it.
Now, baby, you're looking at it. Come on,
wrap me up.
Cause Santa's coming Christmas Eve. Big shiny balls all up on that Christmas tree. Eggnog in my cup, got them carols turned away up. And I don't need much, but what'd you get me?
Come on.
Is it a drone? A new razor? Is it a fancy manscaper with the laser?
Uh-huh.
A Maserati? Bugatti? Man, I thought I had it.
Oh no, baby, you're looking
I'm
at it.
Close,
come
though.
On.
Come on, wrap me up. I'll go get the river.
And that was Jimmy Fallon and Meghan Trainor. And Wrap Me Up, it's a new Christmas classic, or so we'll see. My guest is Gary Stoppelman from the Dubuque Museum of Art. And we've been talking about some classic past stories of your amazing museum in Dubuque, which, by the way, friends, you can find out more about at dbqart.org. But there's a very dynamic future in store. So I'd like to spend a few minutes with you, Gary, if you don't mind. What's on tap for us in the future as we visit the Dubuque Museum of Art?
So I mentioned that we have temporarily relocated to the Millwork District, mm-hmm. and that's been an extraordinary step forward towards the future that we're trying to build. But that future is a totally transformed new museum that will open in 2028 back on Washington Park. And the idea will be to connect the park to the museum to a recently opened child care center on that same block and create really a two-block campus indoors and out that connects the park, the city's historic park, this child care center, a world-class art museum, but also gardens and screening rooms and classrooms and maker spaces and performance spaces and a cafe and the most beautiful event space in the region and, you know, a place to have events and gatherings and programs. And the idea is really to continue to lean into that, you know, now 125-year-old idea of how making and doing can really differentiate the experience for folks, really connect more people to each other and to the arts.
And you talked earlier about this epiphany of empowering people to realize their ability to share their voice through art. Is that part of this vision as well?
Yeah, although it's not really an epiphany. It's what people told us that they wanted. So, you know, look, we live in a world where, and so we're doing all of this planning in 2020. You know, we've been shut in our homes. You know, racial reckoning is happening. The context in Dubuque is you've got a city that its population hasn't been growing. And so how do we continue to grow? How do we continue to be vital? How do we come together to learn from each other? So the first thing that we heard loud and clear was that we are looking for a place to come together. Definitely, right? Because look, at that time, and even more so today, for the museum, our biggest competition is that you can, on your phone, get the greatest art from the greatest collections from all around the world virtually for free and never leave your couch, right? So what is going to get you down? It's going to be a chance to have some kind of a connection, some opportunity to be together, to experience in a way that you can't just on your phone. So there, the first insight there is, of course, the together part. We ended up hiring this incredible group of architects out of New York called Shulaf Rashidi Architects. And the first thing that they did was to gather a heterogeneous group of Dubuquers and ask them, what do we need to know about the people who aren't coming? And that group challenged us with three key notions that really are drove the design and are driving our programming and our approach going forward. The first was, I remember we're sitting in the lobby next to Washington Park, and this gentleman throws his arms open and says, makes a grand gesture towards the park. I want to know that my kids are going to be loved here. Now, for an art museum, that's a challenge traditionally, because traditionally we say, don't run, don't touch, don't make any noise, don't disturb anybody. You know what? Maybe don't come in. Right? So I want to know that my kids are going to be loved here was the first challenge that was issued to us. The second goes back to the second actually was this idea of coming together, learning about other, maybe challenging our perceptions. What we heard was another artist talking about, show me that the media that's important to me is important to you, and I know that I'm important to you. And so that's something that intellectually I understood, but I'd never really heard that blatantly said this idea of media as representation, right? And that person was talking about fashion and animation and digital design, and that the idea, of course, that art is more than just a two-dimensional object on the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that third idea was from parents, and they said, I'm looking for something immersive. And what I thought they meant was, I'm looking for, because this was the moment of those digital Van Goghs exploding all over the country.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that's what they meant, and we will have some of that. But what they actually meant was, I'm looking for something that I can immerse myself in with my children. I'm looking for projects, hands-on experiential learning, where we can together learn and do. And so that has... That means now, today, that what we are going to build on probably the most prominent, important, highly visible site is really going to be not the collection, it's going to be the classrooms.
Wow. This is really exciting. I can't wait to get a chance to and take the grandkids there, not just myself, but to see it all. I do want to, you talked about this ability to sit there with your phone. What I think our challenge is in the post-COVID era, and I'm saying this looking at college-age young persons with whom I get to work, grandchildren who are elementary age, all this kind of thing, is to impress upon them or give them the chance to discover for themselves why it's qualitatively different to come to a piece of art with others or alone. But even if you are walking through a museum by yourself, you're surrounded by so many other artists and stories. And for this, I fall back on one of my favorite friends at the Figge. So I'm going to ask you about your favorite friends in the collection at the Dubuque Museum. But when I go to the Figge, I always want to pop in and say hello to Mrs. Chase. They have a portrait of William Merritt Chase's spouse, painted by William Merritt Chase, who you know, got great rap for his still lifes and things like that. But there's something about this portrait, simply entitled Mrs. Chase, where there is a kindness that comes out of the canvas that could only have been captured by someone who had received that kindness. There is just there's a gentleness about the painting. And so no matter what's going on, and if I'm chasing kids or, you know, whatever, I have to go into the gallery and go see Mrs. Chase. And it's just something I have to do. Who is a good friend of yours at the Dubuque Museum of Art?
Well, right now, so one of the things that I love about working in museums, as we've already established, I did not come up from an art historical background. I came from this theater background.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I love about working in museums is that I will never stop learning, that it's all new to me. And so I don't have, so often my answer to that question is of a moment. And in this case, it's definitely of a moment. Again, Grant Wood, Victorian Survival is a painting that of his Aunt Matilda. And for me, part of it is, as you said, you get a sense of who this person is, who the artist might have been, because in this case, it's not the kindness, it's the humor that comes through. You know that there's sort of when you look at this painting, you know it's made by someone who has a mischievous streak. It's also completely relevant to everything that we were talking about, because it is just a singular portrait of a woman and this newfangled thing called the telephone. It's painted in the style of tintypes, which was an early photographic technology, which is also a moment in time that we are exploring with a contemporary exhibition that travels across time and across the country, which is our Will Wilson exhibition called In Conversation. Will Wilson is an indigenous photographer who works in conversation with the Edward Curtis Collection, which is a collection of tintypes, and he has made this 21st century work where these tintypes come to life and so and have a conversation. Again, now here's the weird thing. By using your phone, you can actually stand, but you have to be in front of the painting.
Yeah. Okay.
You only way to experience this technology is to hold your phone in front of the painting where this extra detail is revealed. The painting subjects will come to life and tell their own story.
Genius.
Or perform their story.
Genius. genius. I can't wait to experience that as well. Some years ago, my son and I went to the Equal Justice Institute in Montgomery, Alabama, and they're at the Legacy Museum, which documents quite graphically the legacy of extrajudicial violence against African-American citizens. And there is one particular place where you sit down and you have a conversation as if you're at a prison phone with someone who was incarcerated on flimsy evidence, and you don't find out until the end what actually happened. So it's a very powerful thing to make it that personal, and I can't wait to experience that with you.
We have a group of Dubuquers in town who are building on a similar story. So there is an early founder in the community who was African-American, and in a horrible case of I don't remember what kind of justice you just described that as, but injustice. He was lynched, and his story was forgotten, and much of the African-American history in Dubuque was erased subsequently. Through some work that the city led, that story has been revealed, and we've got a group of Dubuquers who are in our garden. They're raising money to commission a work of art that will tell the story of that historic story, recognize that it's a part of our story,
right?
But and point us towards this better future.
Right? Yeah. That's another thing. If you get to Montgomery, that's part of the whole Justice Institute, there is an art installation that essentially commemorates every person who was murdered through extrajudicial violence. And it's organized by states.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's jarring for those of us from the upper Midwest or from the Union, if you will.
Yeah.
There's Illinois, there's Iowa, there's Minnesota, there's Wisconsin. There was extrajudicial violence perpetrated in all of those. Well, we're going to run out of time, Gary, and I'm sorry about that.
You'll just have to come visit.
And you'll have to come back. But I always love to ask my guests if you're reading something interesting, if you've seen some media that you'd want to advises us. I already told you my favorite, and I think the listeners are tired of hearing it, but My Friends by Frederick Bachmann is all based on a painting, and you have to read that book.
The thing that's popping into my mind right now that builds off of everything we've been talking about is an interview, and even goes back to Carl Castle through Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is... So Tom Papa, a conversation between Tom Papa and another comedian.
Okay.
And of course, I'm watching it on social media.
Sure.
But they are talking about the intimacy that can happen through digital media in an arena.
Huh.
And so they're talking about, so this is a conversation between two comedians.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're talking about doing comedy in large arenas. And that notion that you can be in an arena with 15,000 people and you don't have to play to the back of the room anymore.
Yeah.
You can arch your eyebrow and the cameras pick up those details.
Well, we love Tom Papa. So that's something that I will certainly look into as my earliest opportunity. But I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and to drive down from Dubuque, which means it's easy for all of us to drive up to Dubuque and check out the Dubuque Museum of Art.
Come continue the conversation.
That's right. I like it. And to find out more, you can always go to dbqart.org. Well, that's going to have to do it for this week. Once again, Gary Stoppelman, Dubuque Museum of Art. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, friends. Well, we've got a nice day today in terms of our clearing skies. The temperature is not going to get a whole lot warmer. In fact, it's going to taper off here pretty quick. It's about 38 now, get down to 41, or up to 41, then back down to 34. Clear skies tonight. Overnight low in the teens. It's going to be sunny tomorrow with a high near 33 degrees. If you're hoping for a white Christmas, you'll need to go someplace else because Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, we're talking about temperatures in the 50s, and that's what we're going to have to deal with this time around. Now, friends, we want you to stay tuned because ahead on WVIK, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Then we want you to join us next week when our guest will be Aubrey Barnes, also known as Mr. Obbs. He is a poet, he is a writer, he's a friend of this program, and you'll want to hear what he has to say, and we hope you'll join us right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. You can find our podcast at WVIK.org, where you're always welcome to tune in to Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM K240 DZ in Dubuque. Coming up on 11 o'clock, we'll get a little news from NPR in Washington, right here on WVIK Rock Island. Then it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, all ahead on your public radio station, WVIK. Remember, pop over to WVIK.org if you'd like to end the year in a generous way by making a donation to help this station recoup from some lost federal funds. Details at WVIK.org.